You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I think you're going to love today's podcast. It's with Margaret Andrews, who is an instructor at Harvard University, where she teaches classes in leadership, organizational culture, emotional intelligence, and creativity. Her class, Managing Yourself and Leading Others, is among the most popular courses and executive programs at Harvard, and the basis for much of her writing and speaking. Margaret is also the founder and managing director of the Milo Center, a private leadership development firm. Her latest book is called Manage Yourself to Lead Others, Why Great Leadership Begins with Self-Understanding. Enjoy the pod. Margaret Andrews, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
There's a story that I recount in my book, Yes And, and it's about a time when we were hired by a Chicago museum to do a sort of team building workshop, but really it was about the one brilliant guy there who couldn't get along with anyone. Mm-hmm. And so this entire workshop was because of that. Needless to say, it did not work. And they had to make the difficult decision to let him go because, you know, brilliant, but it just made everyone else miserable. And your new book kind of starts with a similar story in terms of you, I think, teaching a class. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's actually one of my favorite things that ever happened in the classroom. So I'm teaching this case, and it's about Dr. Ron Ventura, who is a brilliant surgeon and also has terrible interpersonal skills. So very similar to what you just said. Right? Mm-hmm. We love this side. Oh my gosh, this is terrible. And so the class is having a very impassioned discussion about what to do with this guy. On one hand, we have people arguing, let's keep him and coach him, and, you know, so that we can retain these great surgical skills and, you know, buffer off those rough edges. The other side is saying, no way, it's never going to work. We got to get rid of him. He's killing our culture. And so as we're kind of closing down the discussion, I see a hand raised in the back of the room, and it's James. And James has not spoken the whole time, the whole 2 days we've been together. And so, of course, I call on him, and he says, I'm Dr. Ventura. And, you know, just like in the movies that you see where everybody turns around at the same time. And then he realizes what he said, right? And he said, oh, I'm not the real Dr. Ventura. He said, you know, I'm an engineer, not a surgeon. But he said, the rest of that case could have been written about me. And he said, I was recently passed over for a promotion. You know, if I don't fix this, I'm probably going to get fired. And it was one of the most vulnerable things I've ever heard anyone say in a classroom. But what was also really interesting was what happened afterwards, because not long after that, we took a break and everybody wanted to talk to James. Mm. And it showed me, I think, that there are more Dr. Venturas there, but also I thought it also showed that there were a fair number of people that thought they might be Dr. Ventura. So I thought, oh, all right, this is good. And I just thought that was the greatest, bravest thing he could have said, because he cracked it open for lots of other people.
So I'm curious, there's a chicken and egg thing here, and I'm curious for you, what came first, I'm in the leadership business, I'm in the business arena, or I'm in the self-regulation behavioral area? What came first? Are they somehow collide together?
I think they kind of collide together. Yeah, I think so. I feel that a lot of times I will kind of gravitate towards anything that catches my interest, right? And kind of go down silly rabbit holes and things like that. But that is exactly how things come together, right? Is by, you know, what interests you and, oh, what more and what's adjacent to it and those kinds of things.
So, and there's a bit of me search probably here too.
Okay. Absolutely. Isn't that always true?
Oh, no. Absolutely. Completely. So you had a boss one time who said actually you were not self-aware.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that was why the James story resonated with me so much was that, yes, I did have that. And one time, you know, I was doing well in this job, you know, knocking the ball out of the park until one day he was a newish boss. And so we didn't really gel that well, which I think lots of people can understand how that happens. But one time when I was in his office, he sort of looked across the desk at me and said, you're not self-aware. And he didn't say it in a, hey, you may not know this, let me help you with it kind of way. He said it in a, you're broken and cannot be fixed kind of way. Well. And which was stunning, right?
Yeah. Just,
I didn't know what to do, what to say, et cetera. And of course, he went on to say I was, you know, overly ambitious and too demanding and on and on and on. And so I don't even remember the, you know, how the meeting ended, but, you know, I couldn't hear it, right? I couldn't hear it. It hit so hard. But, you know, much later when I really, I'll say calmed down first, and then really started thinking about it, that I realized, oh, you know, I think he's right. I think he's right. And at that time, you know, I know that there were people on my team that felt anxious, and some of them felt underappreciated. And I think that's, and of course, my relationship with my boss was certainly underperforming. And I didn't want that. You know, it was a situation that I had created inadvertently. It was not what I wanted. But I had only myself to look at for why it was that way. And so that was kind of when I vowed, I don't like this. I don't want this. This will not stand kind of thing. And that's when I started saying, okay, what am I going to do about it? And so then I just went on a nerd research thing about, you know, what can I learn? Who can I learn from? You know, what is philosophy say? What is, you know, the academic research say? All of, you know, anything that I saw a strand, I would pull on it. And that's where it all kind of led to this one thing, which is you have to understand and manage yourself first, right? That's where it comes in.
Well, and you were able to name it, and of course, someone named it for you to start.
Yeah,
and that happens sometimes, but that ability to be willing to work on yourself over a course of time, to me, has been the hallmark of every good interaction I've had with another human being, and in particular. Because you're big on making lists. We are too. At Second City, there's a lot of list making. And you talk about this idea of, like, think about your best boss, think about the attributes and all that. I have one. I kind of worked on that. You had one. His name was Mike. What made him a great boss?
What made him a good boss, and I say this, that he, I don't think he ever took a leadership class in his life, but he is a literary scholar. And I remember he told me one time, he said, really good authors are good authors because they understand the human condition and they understand human emotion. And he said, that's what leadership is understanding people and how they operate. And I've always sort of hung on to that and it keeps coming back to me over time. But, you know, he was somebody that He never liked meetings, so you would never be in a meeting with Mike, or almost never. He would walk around, literally every morning he would walk around the office, and he would just come into your office and he would talk to you, and it was all very casual, right? And he knew everybody, he knew their names, he knew if they had kids, the names of those kids. And in fact, I will tell you, I invited him to my book launch party, and he came over, and my three kids, who are now adults, were also there. And he walked up to each one of my kids and he said, hey, the last time I saw you, and he said something, and they were all blown away, right? Because my daughter, because he said, the last time I saw you, you were thinking about medical school. And I remember you got a suturing kit for Christmas and you were working on chicken breasts, right? And she, her eyes were so wide open. She's like, I can't believe you would remember that. And I thought, that's why, right? Mm-hmm. He knew those kinds of things. And to this day, now it's, you know, 20 years later or whatever, he still remembers those, which to me is just amazing. But that kind of encapsulates why he was so good.
I was thinking about this. I'm pretty sure my best boss is my boss I have now, Ed. And I say this because I know he does not listen to the podcast. I can guarantee you he is not. He talks to me enough that he does not want to hear more Kelly Leonard. But one of the things that I love about working for him is he has about accountability, but mutually. Mm-hmm. And that is the difference that I was like, oh, this is very different, which is you are holding me accountable, but you also are holding yourself accountable to me. And when you let me down, you let me know. And when I let you down, you let me know. and we just had it like, I did something stupid recently. And he's like, hey, I just wanted to cover off on this because I think we don't need to talk about it again. I'm like, okay, great. Yes, I'm sorry. I get it. I got the note. And this is actually a big thing at Second City, which is we have a sort of a phrase around when a director is giving notes to an ensemble, usually after a show when they're improvising and working on a new show. And the thing is, take the note.
It doesn't mean
you have to. Well, you would say take the effing note, but take the note.
Yes, that too.
Yeah. Well, it's like you don't have to actually do it. You don't have, but in the moment, take it. And then if you have a question for the director later about that note, that's fine. But they are trying to steer you in a way to make it better, and in the context of a group. So they're going to give you a note, and it's their best idea. If you find another way there, no one's going to complain about that.
Right.
But fighting the note, it leads to like the worst outcomes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's true, not just in improv, right?
No.
I oftentimes think that's true with feedback. You know, I oftentimes ask people to think about, you know, what feedback they've received. And I say, pay close attention to feedback you disagreed with, and also feedback that surprised you. Right. Because they're oftentimes in that same vein because, you know, there's that old adage that feedback is a gift. And I say, and gifts can come in ugly packages. It doesn't mean that they're not valuable gifts, but they can be ugly. And I think a lot of times the ones that surprise us or we disagree with are the effing notes, right? Those are the ones that you want to push back on. But it's that gift of a perspective that you didn't have, right? Somebody is seeing something and you can internalize it later and say, you know, do I agree with this? Let me think about more about it. But at least now you have the perspective. You didn't have that before.
All right. I want to describe an improv exercise we do in a lot of our corporate workshops, and it relates to when you talk about intentions and behaviors and all that. So it's called thank you statues, and we have the group go in a circle, and we ask someone from the circle to step into the center and strike a pose. And then the instruction is, okay, so what we have to do now is anyone who's in the circle can step in and strike another pose next to this person, and then they're going to say thank you, and then they're going to leave. Go. And so what, of course, happens, which is no one moves, and that person is stuck there. And maybe finally someone comes in, and we're like, okay, so what's going on, right? And we're like, why didn't you step in? They're like, well, I didn't know if, like, I was the right person, maybe someone else. Like, for the person in the middle, what did you want someone to do? I just wanted someone to come in.
Yes.
That's all they needed to do. And that what we're trying to teach is, like, you know, you might have an intention, but all this person cares about is what you do. And did you come in to relieve them, to get them out of there? And none of you did.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's true. And I think what you're referring to is what I say of that, that we judge ourselves by our intentions, but other people judge us by our behavior. And I think that's such a great I want to go to your class, actually.
We can arrange that.
Because that's exactly right. That, you know, I will say that understanding what I just said gave me a lot more empathy for previous bosses, ones that I thought were not very good and some who I actually thought kind of had it out for me. And I realized, my gosh, No, I bet you they didn't. I bet you they really meant to be a good boss. But, you know, they were learning on me. Just like, you know, when we're starting to lead other people, we make a lot of mistakes, too.
Morgan Housel is a recent guest. I keep bringing up this quote because, like, when someone nails a quote, it's the best thing in the world. And this thing came from his brother-in-law, which is, everyone's behavior makes sense if you have enough information.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I think that is so true. I think Stephen Covey said something like that, or mm-hmm. maybe it was something like that, but it was everybody's behavior makes perfect sense to them.
Yeah.
Right. They're not acting, strangely to them. But to your point or your other guest's point is that we just don't know what that backstory is.
No, but we can find out.
Yes. Yes.
And that leads to a thing. You talk about this in chapter 3. You say, quote, leadership emerges from our life story in our unique portfolio of experiences, influences, ways of thinking, values, and ambitions, end quote. This is so important as it relates to leadership, culture building, storytelling, relationships. And I don't know that it is taught in business school that often. I mean, I know it is more now. You're doing it. But this idea of like, no, all those experiences, everything, every ounce that you bring in is part of and should be part of this other world that you're in, that yes, you're making a living from, you're also spending probably most of your waking hours at.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the thing is that, you know, I think there's a Zen saying that says, wherever you go, there you are, right? And mm-hmm. I think, yes, wherever you go, there you are. And so is all of your past, right? Because you bring that with you. And so I think that is one of the most important things is really to understand your own backstory and how your own backstory is not always back, right? You bring it with you. What was that quote? I'm blanking on the author that said it. The past isn't dead. In fact, the past isn't even past. You know, that we bring it with us. And so I do. I think that that's really important to understand it because it doesn't, and it can be hard for a lot of people because it takes some courage to really look at those things. But then I love quotes by authors too. C.S. Lewis said, you know, you can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, that feels like a very improv quote. Right?
Yeah. I always quote Irving Yalom, who says, sooner or later, you have to give up the hope for a better past.
That's great. That is great, yeah. Right? It is. It is. And lots of people have had odd and troubling and hard things in their past, but it makes them who they are.
And the learning, you talk about this, and we know from improv, it's this zone of discomfort that is where the learning happens. And like, I don't think you can name a thing that is of real value and really important to you that isn't hard.
Yeah, I think that that's true. You know, I was actually at the Mary Chapin Carpenter concert last night, and I love one of her songs where the chorus line is "Everything we got the hard way." I think there is a very, very similar. Is that when you think back to the hardest times, they are the times in some ways you remember with fondness, right? Because you got through it, and you got something from it.
Yeah, I mean, no rational human being would have a child.
and more than one, let's say.
We're out of our minds for doing that. I mean, it's expensive, it is hard work, you lose your time, and yet, I can't speak to anything that has been more important than my two children.
I agree. And actually, you know, having children that actually made me understand leadership more in the sense that, you know, I have three kids and before having children, I knew nothing about children. I had never changed a diaper. Mm-hmm. I did very little babysitting when I was younger. So, you know, as I was leaving the hospital with my first son, I remember thinking that, you know, if they knew how little I know about what I'm about to do, they would never let me leave with him. Yeah. But apparently they didn't know and they let me leave. And so I had to learn everything mm-hmm. about babies in general, but him in particular. And so when I had my second one, I thought, oh, I got it now, you know, and then I realized, oh, no, I don't. He has his own moods and likes and dislikes and sense of humor and all of these kinds of things, totally different from his brother. Yeah. And then my daughter comes along and I think, all right, now I got it, right? Again, I was totally wrong. And that is when it dawned on me that, you know, if my own genetic material is not similar, why would I expect some random collection of strangers at work to be similar at all? And that was, you know, that blinding flash of the obvious. And that's what it felt like. It's like, how could I not have known that? But I didn't. I didn't know that.
It's funny. You don't talk about that much around generations in the workplace, but, you know, this is a conversation, of course, mm-hmm. that is happening. My wife is a college professor, so I'm always... And I've always worked with young people. And it's, yes, of course there are differences. They are wildly overstated.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I believe that too.
It's right? just crazy because, like, oh, young people can be difficult. Like, have you not, like, do you have any awareness of what you were like as a young person? Like,
yes. So, yeah.
And I think it's similar to this idea of like, get to know them, like, and this is as simple as asking a few questions and people are more than willing to sort of share. You have a point in the book where you say emotions are data. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so crucial because we still live under this false, premise that somehow, the workplace can be an emotion free, terrain. And it's like, well, first of all, like, well, no. And then even like, why would you want it to be?
Oh, well, you know, I tell people in class, and they think it's funny, but I'm actually thinking we should do this, is that I've been in meetings, I bet we all have, where somebody says, well, let's just leave our emotions at the door. And I said, next time I'm in a meeting where anyone says that, I'm going to get up and walk over to the door, right? Because you can't yeah. leave your emotions at the door. And by the way, you shouldn't. And that's actually a quote from Susan David, who talks about emotions mm-hmm. as data. And, you know, you, it doesn't mean you have to, it's not a directive, as she says, right? Doesn't mean, because when you're angry, you might want to do something that you would later regret. So, but it's telling you, you are angry, you know, something is blocking you. And therefore, that's probably why you're feeling angry. But yeah, they are data. And so that little uncomfortable feeling you have in your gut sometimes that uncomfortable feeling is saying, stop. And other times it's saying, oh, this is going to be risky, but go anyway, right? But you got to listen to it.
I want to talk a bit about mentoring and coaching. And then I also want to talk to you a bit about sponsoring, which mm-hmm, is another mm-hmm. thing. But talk to us about the difference between, let's start with mentoring and coaching. How are those two things different?
Yeah, so they're very similar ideas, right, is that we're trying to help somebody get from here to there. So mentoring is really where you give somebody the benefit of your experience. So if somebody is new on the job or something like that, I might say, hey, try this. Or, oh, you're having a difficult time talking to so-and-so, hey, they're really interested in this, try this angle, right? So that it's more of a telling or a suggesting, whereas coaching is more about questions and question, you know, so what were you thinking, you know, during that time? And, you know, if you were in that situation again tomorrow, you know, would you want to deal with it a little differently? So it's more, I think of mentoring as from me to you, and whereas coaching is me asking you, but it's from you. And so different times can be helpful to mentor and different times to coach. But one of the things I think about coaching is that you're helping them solve the problem for themselves, mm-hmm. right? And you're building their efficacy in, right? If they can solve this problem, they feel really good. And now they have some skills to think about this a little bit differently.
So that in the world of theater and improv, particular directors and in improv, they call them often coaches. At Second City, we're a theater, so we also use the term director. But they are also, you know, getting the actor to. You're not giving line readings. You're not mm-hmm. saying say it this way because they don't learn anything. It's like that you guide them and you side coach and you get them to make that discovery themselves. And then we had Rosalind Chow on the podcast, and she talked about sponsoring, mm-hmm. and her thing mm-hmm. is. Mentoring is when you're talking to a person. Sponsoring is when you're talking about someone.
Yes, yes, that's
and
right.
And I love that too, because it's like, I think these are important distinctions that words are important, and these are all different things. And quite frankly, successful leaders are doing a little bit of all of that at different times.
Because I think it's not just the person, right? And so the leader, you know, you might think person A, person B, person C, one person needs coaching, one person needs mentoring. I say it's actually usually not the person, it's the situation. That sometimes you might need to coach and sometimes it'd be more effective to mentor.
At any point, did you consider calling this book It Depends?
Actually, I have a class called It Depends, which is... It's called, because for years and years and years, people would ask a very specific question. What should I do in this situation with my boss? And I would always say, well, it depends, right? And I realized, well, that's a very unsatisfactory answer. And but it does, right? It depends on who is it? What are the stakes? What have you tried before? Who else is it, right? You can think of 40 different things that are going on. But then I started saying, okay, how can I help people understand what it depends on? And so, yes, I believe there is, I won't say never, but almost never a single right answer to any question in leadership. But, you know, you try something today and it works. You might try the same thing tomorrow and it won't work because it's not the same situation.
No, and there are so many variables. Mm-hmm. It could be it's not the same situation. It could be something external changed. It could be something internal changed. It could be different people. So the idea that you're going to have any sort of sequential, linear solution set, and by the way, this has always been true, and it's just way more true right now in a AI universe and in the political environment, social environment, and that like – You know, so like, and this is the thing that keeps catching us up. Of course, you know where I work, and you know, alumni of the theater have been in the news and other sort of people in the comedy world. For we just assumed we could say all the things we get to say, and suddenly you can't. And then what does that mean?
Yeah,
you know, and it is truly complex, and it speaks to this larger idea of culture, which is really what one of the things I wanted to get in into with you because. It's such a squishy concept. It's such a squishy word. People throw culture around. So talk us to a bit about how you make that sort of tacit.
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole idea of culture, I think, to me, there's many words that we use that have lost their meaning because everybody uses them in a different way. And I think culture can be a little bit like that. So, you know, I always think of David Foster Wallace one time gave a commencement address at Kenyon, and he started it off with a little tiny anecdote. He said, you know, two fish are swimming through the pond one day and they encounter an older fish swimming toward them. And the older fish says, hi, boys, how's the water? And the two fish swim on, and the one turns to the other and says, "What the hell is water?" Right? And he's talking about this is your life. You know, your life is the water. And I always think that's a great way to think about culture is it's the water. It's the air you're breathing kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of times we think of culture as the way we do things around here. And that's actually a pretty good proxy for it. And because, you know, if you go from one company to another company or one family to another family, they do things differently. And it's not that one is better or worse. They're different, and some may be better or worse for you, right? And so it kind of goes back to this, it depends. Because when somebody says, oh, they have a terrible culture, I always want to append it by saying, for you, right? That culture actually works for other people. That's why that culture is there. So it, like when we think about culture in an organization, it's not just what you see and what you hear and what you feel. It's about, you know, how people treat each other and what is considered funny. And, you know, who treats who different ways, you know, does everybody dress the same or is there more individuality or these kinds of things? So the culture is kind of you know, the water that we're swimming in. And that's why it's so squishy, as you say. It's hard to get your arms around. And that's why I always loved the work of Ed Schein from MIT. Mm-hmm. And he talks about these layers, right? The first is the artifacts. These are things that you can see, right? Is it, I used to do this when I was working full time at Harvard, I would oftentimes bring people for lunch over to the faculty club. And so right before we'd go through the door, I'd say, close your eyes for a second and tell me what you think the inside looks like. Mm-hmm. Right? And they'd close their eyes and then and they'd think. And I said, don't tell me. And then we'd walk through the door and I'd say, is this what you thought it was? And they'd say, exactly what I thought it was, right? So they were dark wood paneling, overstuffed chairs, you know, photos of old dead white men, you know, paintings, actually. They didn't have photography then. Yeah. So it is, those are kind of artifacts, things you see. But below that are these values that kind of, those are hard to get under, to understand. And there's what we call, why is the word escaping me? Not enacted, but espoused values.
Espoused values.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is what we say we value. This is what we say why we have a clean desk policy or why we say we do these things. And then enacted values are actually the values that come out when you make decisions. So, you know, the classic one, actually, and a friend of mine worked in an organization where they talked endlessly about how they wanted everybody to, you know, take care of their lives and their health and these kinds of things. And yet every month they gave the above and beyond award, right? Which was for the person who just worked these crazy hours to get things done, right? So espoused values, take care of yourself, right? Enacted values, grind. And then, of course, beneath that is what they talk about is these shared tacit assumptions. And these are like these deeply held beliefs about the way the world works. And that's what is driving a lot of culture.
Yeah, I will tell you the one that kicked my butt in COVID and George Floyd was the show must go on, which is something we all believed and we took it as a badge of honor. And they were like, oh, was this actually a thing that pushed poor actors when they were sick to work for greedy producers? And in fact, it was. Now, there are elements of it that I still love. With regard to the way we push through and the way we do our work. But, you know, this is a change that came very late in my career and late in terms of the industry I'm in. And so this idea of like, well, the culture changes. And the other thing I think of is this dance between culture and the self. And the fact for individuals, I think that many of us are still stuck in the idea that there's one authentic self.
Oh, yeah. I think so.
You know what I mean? This is Goffman's work, and I love it. But, I mean, there are many selves. You present yourself very differently in tons of different situations, and that does not make you inauthentic. It makes you.
Right. I mean, the idea of we contain multitudes, right?
Sure.
And I think that is really true, that there are me on really great days, and there's me when I'm feeling down or when I'm feeling threatened or, right, that all of these different things. And our emotions play into this. And I think that the whole idea of one me, right, which is why I do like looking at backstories, because you understand that there are so many threads, right? There's so many influences in your life, throughout your life, and that you are being pulled by different ones, or different ones are coming out at different times. And that doesn't mean that you are being inauthentic or not you. No, that's just like a different facet of you.
All right, in a moment I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, but I'm sort of curious, if you have a goal for this book ends up in a bunch of people's hands, what do you hope that they take away? What's the thing? Yeah.
Oh, gosh, just one? So,
doesn't have to be the one.
I was going to say, but really what I believe that if we all understood ourselves a little bit better, that the world would be a better place, that we would all just chill out a little bit and realize that most of the time, most people aren't thinking about you. And so it just lets you ratchet it down a little bit. So if we understand ourselves, I think that we find our roots, right? And then when you have those roots, you are not buffeted by every wind that goes by. And I think understanding ourselves helps us to understand other people. So, and I would say that people would make the effort, right? If we could move the needle a little bit on understanding and managing ourselves, I think we move the needle on leadership. And that is at the family level, at the organizational level, at the friendship level, at societal levels, right? So this, I think that there can be a positive spiral and not just a negative spiral. So that would be what I would hope would happen.
I absolutely love that. And the best thing I ever did for myself as a business person was when I just went through therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, people joke about that. I'm like, that's no joke, right? That is actually, that could be one of the best gifts that you can give to yourself. Absolutely.
Yeah. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. You have one for us?
Yeah. So actually, I think it's a very recent one. And it was one that happened. It actually just kind of came out of my mouth before I could stop it. I teach classes, like 15-week classes, right, with papers and stuff like that. And so I boiled them down to a 2-day like executive program. And I oftentimes get client calls for, can you do this in a day? And I'm like, yeah, we can do it in a day. And I got a call from a client organization. They said, can you do it in a half hour? And I said, yes. And I'm like, oh my God, where did that come from?
Why did I say yes to this?
And right, why did I say yes to this? And you know, I worked really, really hard. I said, okay, what can I throw out? And what exercise can I do that will, you know, showcase these 5 different things, et cetera. And I got it down to a half hour.
Wow.
And so, but I, you know, I have to say, I got this one time from a guy at Harvard, David Malin, who teaches a very successful class called CS50, Computer Science 50. And he told me that when he was going from his regular class to doing something where, remember all the MOOCs where we were going to do this? And he said he had this thing that he set up and he would, I think he said it was like an hour long. And he said he worked really hard and he got it down to like 5 minutes and he filmed it. And then he went back and he said, oh, it's still too long. Right. And he wow. got it down to really, really short. And so that just stayed with me. And I thought, and he's a fabulous instructor. Right. And I thought, oh, I'm going to learn from that. And so I said, yes, before I even knew what I was saying, but then I just channeled that and said, I'll figure it out.
I love it. The book is called Manage Yourself to Lead Others, Why Great Leadership Begins with Self-Understanding. Margaret Andrews, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much. This is a pleasure.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.